All right, this hour, as we continue chatting with Michelle Ballanger, we'll also take your phone calls here on Coast to Coast AM, so get ready. And we're back with Michelle Ballanger. Her website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com for you as we talk about demonology. Are you convinced now, Michelle, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that these demons are happening? They're not a figment of some people's imagination or mental illness?
From my experience, there are definitely spirits that fall under that term. Whether or not they are part of a fight between good and evil, damnation and redemption, I think that's best left to the theologians. But in the field, there's definitely some stuff out there.
I think so, too. Since you've been doing this, what would you say the future holds for this kind of field?
I have definitely seen an uptick in activity over the 20, 25 years that I've been doing this. And talking to other people who are seasoned veterans, that's been something that's been on the rise for decades. And, I mean, all we have to do is look around to say we are in a very, very different sort of time. It's a volatile time, not just, you know, in the mundane world, but in the spiritual world. And I think we should educate ourselves and be very firm and adopt pretty healthy boundaries, because we're moving into very uncharted territory.
It is uncharted. And who's going to chart it for people? I mean, will there be people like you who might be able to do that?
I'm a firm believer that each person should seek their own truth. And I don't think that, you know, any one person can stand up and say, this is how we should do it. This is how we're going to get through it. I think each of us has to listen to our gut, to, you know, that still small voice that tells us what is right and who, if there's someone we should follow, who that person is. You know, more than anything else, I think that we all should definitely look out for one another and be open to extreme possibility, because I think that's where we're moving.
I think so, too. Calls are rolling in for you, Michelle. We'll get to them in just a second. Of all the cases you've handled, specifically handled, was there one that just was so baffling to you, you still can't figure it out?
The one that I'd mentioned that was in Rochester, and I think mainly because I didn't have the opportunity to, like, fully do closure with it, the part that confused me the most was, you know, I, as a sensitive person, as a psychic, there's a lot of things I perceive with not necessarily like my eyes, my ears. Spirits and things don't really like show up like that. But one of the tricky things with possession, you know, they're really not making stuff up when they say that people's faces can change in ways that defy physics. And the person who was at the core of this particular issue looked like different people on different occasions. I truly did not realize I was dealing with the same person from one half of the day to the second half of the day.
Wow.
And I'm still trying to wrap my head around it.
It was that dramatic.
Yeah, no, it was that dramatic of a change. And, like, I was like, guys, but this isn't, like, who's this new guy sitting at the table? And they're like, well, it's the dude that we were talking to earlier. I'm like, no, like, his face. Like, what even is going on here? Like, what the hell?
All right, let's take some calls here for you. Joe in the Bronx, welcome to the show, Joseph. Go ahead.
Hey, George, how are you?
All righty.
Good. Michelle, I wanted to ask you if you've ever had the experience of having to evoke the name of Michael the Archangel, whether it was in the case of a haunting or a possession, you know, with you and your party.
Well, Father Bob actually was part of Michael the Archangel was his whole spiritual society thing. So before we would do any work that he was involved in, they always did the St. Michael prayer. So that was kind of just the baseline for Paranormal State.
Elaborate a little bit more on that, Michelle.
There's a traditional Catholic prayer, St. Michael the Archangel, protect us in battle. And it's longer. I don't think that I could rattle it off the top of my head.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a while. But for Ryan Buell and Father Bob, particularly, who were the ones who would be most involved in the demonic cases on that show. That was pretty much their patron saint. And so they did a lot of work to ask for Michael's help whenever they felt that that was something that they were going to face.
Every Christmas Day, I play a tape, a letter from Michael, which was in a recording that Lee Allen, a great broadcaster, did a long time ago, about a soldier in the Korean War and talking about, you know, Michael saving them. And it's pretty dramatic and very emotional, too, by the way. Thanks, Joe. Appreciate you being part of the program. Let's go next to Keith in Tennessee, east of the Rockies. Hi, Keith. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, George. I'm glad you took my call tonight. I'm originally from Pontiac, Michigan. I know you know that area.
I sure do.
I have two questions for your guest, and I'll make them quick. The first one is, have you ever heard of a Nephilim in the Catholic religion or any other religion? And
absolutely.
The second question is Lucifer considered an archangel, and is he Michael's brother?
Okay, by tradition, Lucifer is an archangel, a seraphim, one of the highest, and the first. Whether or not he and Michael are actually brothers is more folklore and myth. It's not something that you're going to find, like, literally in biblical tradition. Now, the Nephilim, I could do a whole nother episode on that. One of my areas of expertise is the Book of Enoch and the Enochic tradition. The Nephilim, Gibberim, and Anakim are all part of the Grigori, or the Watcher Angels. More specifically, the Nephilim are the children of the Watcher Angels. So there is a tradition where 200 angels came down, or were sent, or fell from heaven. It really depends on which version you read, and mingled with the daughters of men. There's a very small portion of Genesis that mentions this, and their children were the Nephilim, the giants in the earth. In Enoch, they are given as the reason for the flood, because as human-angel hybrids, they were partly of heaven and partly of earth and really didn't belong anywhere in reality. They had massive appetites. They ate flesh, they drank blood, they did terrible sins against animals and people, and a cry went up to heaven. And the archangels got involved, and there's all sorts of nifty stuff to read out of that.
How do we know, Michelle, that these fallen angels weren't, if you read the Bible in Genesis, interpreted as extraterrestrials coming down here?
We don't. And that's one of the things, is like what we have is the written record. And if you, there is no way to know for sure. What we do know, actually, Andrew Collins makes a really good argument for them being either people of a very, very different and advanced civilization or of alien extraction. Definitely not from around the place of the people recording it, because they looked different. They were taller. They had a different color to their skin. Their eyes were different. Their hair was different. And those things we know from the written record. But, you know, it's written by, so the Book of Enoch is supposedly written by Enoch. It's most likely to have been written by somebody who wasn't Enoch, but is still, you know, from that culture. But the Watchers, there's no way to be 100% certain.
Well, and as the Catholic Church has pointed out, that the belief in extraterrestrial life does not negate one's belief in God. And that was pretty dramatic when they came out with that statement a few years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. What we know from the written record in the Book of Enoch is there were 200. They were very different. They came down. They mingled. And that mingling led to some pretty terrible things. Now, it also led to good things, because the thing of it was, is when they took wives among them, they also brought technology, everything from making cosmetics for beautifying people to the making of weapons and the crafting of metals. from the reading, Barachiel taught the signs of the clouds, and Sauriel taught the signs of the moon, which most people interpret as the calendar. Shamsiel taught the sign of the sun. There was divination of various sorts, and Kokhobiel was the signs of the stars. There was another one that taught poisonings and smitings, including the stilling of the infant in the womb, which is a pretty clear reference to abortion.
Well, that's a good point. Next up, let's go to Mira in Los Angeles. Hello, Mira, go ahead.
Me?
Yeah.
Oh, great. Okay, well, I'm really enjoying the conversation tonight. I wanted to make a comment, and then I wanted to ask a question. So, okay. I have observed what I would call demons in human beings, and I consider them, I've observed different types. Some seem very, very sane, but they are authors of confusion. And you have to really look into their words and see what they're saying and what kind of ideas they're trying to propagate, usually for control.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also, which I'm familiar with, is the demons that enter into people through drugs.
Drugs and alcohol, yeah.
Yeah, especially through like things like meth or cocaine. I'm not really talking about marijuana or psilocybin. And but I also wanted to ask a question about architecture, as I know that the guest loves old buildings. And if we think about the last 100 years, the devastation of beautiful architecture all across this world, and also temples, and all of this stuff is being either bombed out or torn down at a rapid pace. And I was wondering what this has to do with the relationship to the spirit world. Thank you.
If anything, Michelle, does it?
Well,
I'm not sure it does.
I'm not sure that it does. And yet, you know, there was that. So I'm sure everybody remembers the day that Notre Dame burned. But
yes.
It wasn't the only holy place. It wasn't the only church or temple that burned that day. It was the most spectacular, but there was a mosque. And then I have a friend who is studying Vajrayana Buddhism, and there was, I believe, a Buddhist temple that also. And it was the confluence of those events that seemed very peculiar.
Mm-hmm.
Three of them, the fires started like on roofs, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I don't think they were construction workers that screwed up.
Well, I not being there, I can't say for sure, but
yeah, but three times
really does. Yeah, well, no, it really does seem like there's some order to that, some other hand. I mean, my opinion is, it is a great evil when works of art, and particularly things that have been erected for the betterment of humanity, are destroyed, whether by the hands of humans or other intelligence.
Oh, it's pure evil.
We are diminished when that happens. That much I can say for sure.
Yep. Pat's in St. Louis. Go ahead, Pat, first-time caller.
Hi, George. Michelle, first-time caller. I can't believe I got through, but George, you're a St. Louis treasure, and I listened to you for years, and keep up the good work.
Go Blues, right?
Oh, yeah. Go Blues. Actually, I have a futures bet on the Blues at 25-1, so.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. You could hit on that one.
Yeah, I hope. I got $142, so anyway. I live near the Exorcist house here in Belmore and St. Louis. And I've been intrigued by this story my whole life. So I've done my homework, and I've talked to people, Father Bowden's relatives. I have a friend that actually lives on the street that knew one of the priests involved. And one of the most intriguing things I've heard on it is she told me that his name was Father Boland, not Bowden, Boland, and he was involved in holding down the boy during the exorcism, And George, if you could get him on your air, on the air, that would be a coup, because he's in his 80s, retired from NASA, and he lives in Maryland.
Ah, okay.
Anyway, my question is, they holding the boy down, they saw writing on his body, she told me, that the priest told her, and it was really scary to him. It had the number 64, and they thought, they didn't know what that meant at first, and then they figured it was 64 demons. And then the other tidbit, they brought the boy, and there's a couple diaries out there. Well, the one diary that's out there to the public that the Booth brothers put out there when they did their documentary, you know, that was pretty good, but it's sketchy. But they brought the boy to the St. Vincent's Asylum, and it's not documented in the diary. And the place was bona fide haunted. The nuns condemned it in 1949 on the fifth floor, and it's still condemned to this day. It's Section 8 housing. It's called Castle Park Apartments. So I wanted to get your take on it. And also, kind of a tidbit, the last three digits of the phone number at the place are 666.
Don't call that number.
Exactly. It's under Castle Park Apartments. But anyway, thanks, and George, thank you, and I'll listen to you. Thank you.
Okay. All right, very good. Well, you know, an exorcist can get hurt doing what they're doing, Michelle, can't they?
There is danger, physical danger, because if someone is genuinely possessed, they get pretty strong, and they can lash out. And then there is a lot of belief that there is spiritual danger, that you are, you know, there's that saying that if you gaze into the abyss can gaze back at you. Well, this is like, you know, shouting at the abyss and giving it the middle finger.
That's from the movie Wall Street, right?
I think it's a little older than that, but, you know, it does hold true. Like, that you are, if you're standing against the darkness is going to know your name.
And what do you think of that apartment complex he was talking about, Castleman?
I have had some really, well, not bad experiences personally, but I have had to investigate some pretty hairy hauntings when a site like that gets turned into housing.
Yes. Or where it's, you know, been created and built on, like a cemetery,
yeah,
or something.
Well, especially if nobody made any effort to clear it out, to clean it up. And, you know, your average person doesn't really know how to do that. And I do not want to naysay anybody, but, like, just grabbing some sage and waving it at it isn't going to do it. Because if you don't, the sage itself is not the thing that's going to clean it. Like, you have to know how to clear it. There has to be intent behind it. There has to be belief, faith.
Yeah, just burning sage, that's not going to do it.
I mean, it'll make it smell different. But, you know, if you are from the tradition, if you are from the lineage where sage is part of your sacred toolkit, that's going to have a lot more meaning. But, you know, we've kind of appropriated that. And again, just, you know, waving sage around isn't going to fix it. You need some really deep cleaning and some people who are dedicated to doing that.
All right, we're going to come back and take final phone calls for you, Michelle, when we roll right back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to our final segment with Michelle Ballanger as we talk about demons and demonic spirits. I do believe, Michelle, in angels, don't you?
Yeah. Well, you can't believe in one without the other. Like, they're intertwined, especially in Judaism.
You can't have demons without the angels.
Yeah. And again, if you're going with the biblical tradition, one comes from the other. It's just which side of the fence they find themselves on.
And, of course, do you think angels are given specific roles and tasks?
If I go off of the hierarchies that have become canon in the church, there's definitely different roles that things are given. And so you've got powers, principalities, dominions, the seraphim, the thrones. And there's a fairly complicated hierarchy of orders of angels, usually nine, three sets of three. And it's somewhat arranged in, like, how close they are to God and then how close they are to the earth.
All right, let's go to the phones. Michelle is in Kansas City, Missouri. Nope, she's not ready. Let's go to Faith in Wilmington, California. Hi, Faith. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I've been dealing with a real demonic possession for the past 4 years now. Well, in 2014, the torture was so bad, I had to be put on the high single doses of schizophrenia medication that they can give you. Because I would beg for those pills because they would put me to sleep. I would be in the most pain and suffering. My whole body, there was two separate times for that month period where my body just completely contorted around. I was thrown into like sexual positions. It was the one of the most painful things I've ever been through.
And it's still happening?
Yes, I still deal with it today. I still feel the demon's presence all the time. Like when I try to leave, the most recent issue that I've had with it, when I try to leave LA, I all of a sudden, I was in Washington for 9 days trying to get clean. And after like the seventh day that I was there, I could only look up, like my eyes would roll all the way back. There's no way I could have lived that way for
Let me ask you something here, Faith. When did this first start? What happened to you?
Well, I guess it started with the computer at my house. When I lived in Gardena, the computer seemed to be, like, I thought somebody had the controls over it. Somebody had hacked into it. And then all of a sudden I started hearing all these creaks and these bumps, and I heard voices in my head. And
so you think this happened through a computer and got you?
I don't know how it came to be, but the physical symptoms were so extreme that there's no way it could have been anything else.
Michelle, is it possible they got her that way?
Well, I would want to follow the list of diagnoses that the Catholic Church would as well is first rule out any psychiatric issues and, you know, have a full workup with a licensed psychiatrist. And then whatever your religious background is, if you have a religious background, also follow that up with whoever is the priest that you go to, but work in tandem, because one of the other things to keep in mind is there's a lot of trauma that can happen with, you know, true demonic possession. So even if there are no underlying psychological issues before, if something is going on, issues can also arise. So you want to have someone treating you hand in hand, psychiatry and spiritually.
That's a necessity. Now let's go to Michelle in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Michelle. Go ahead. You're on with Michelle.
Hello to both of you. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing.
Michelle, I am 48 years old, and back in 1990 or 91 in college was the first time I ever goofed around with the Ouija board with my girlfriends that were in my sorority. We immediately had very dramatic results, and we kept getting specific movements from the the little movement piece that has a name. Anyway, it would move.
The planchette.
Yes, thank you. It would move specifically when certain quote-unquote entities would present themselves. You could tell that it was really them or not because of the way they were moving on the board. And one kept presenting itself to me in particular, but also in the room, if I was in the room and my girlfriends were on the board. And it would say, M-A, M-A, M-A. Well, it told me that it followed me around all the time. We made it prove itself. It told a extremely specific situation, location, and activities that I was doing the night before and where I was. And I literally was almost in tears over it. And subsequently, any usage of the Ouija board after that, a few months later or a year later, it would still be there, and it said it followed me around. Fast forward 3 or 4 years after that, around 1994, I was about ready to use it again with my boyfriend's mother, who was missing her husband's Rolex watch, and we wanted to find it, and we were goofing around. It played with us back and forth. It was giving us insane clues, but the spot that it found a watch, it wasn't the Rolex, was on a shelf where you had to climb on the counter, and it was, it kept saying camera and stirrup. They have a barn. We went out to the barn, looked around for the watch in the tack room. It wasn't anywhere. We climb up on this counter because it said camera, where she said she kept some cameras. We looked up there. There were two old cameras, and next to it was a little tiny miniature, you know, souvenir of stirrups. And behind that was a watch.
Ha, huh, that's amazing. All by itself. Not the Rolex, but a watch.
Not the Rolex, but a watch. And we were both literally in tears. And there were about maybe 8 or 9 other scary, very specific examples. But my question for you is, this is in 90 or 91, M-A-M-A, it has always bothered me because it said it always was with me, it followed me everywhere. I found out a few months ago from my niece, she said, oh my God, that's a known demon, also known as Zozo. Well, I lost my mind because in the 90s, this is before the internet or any of that monkey business, we weren't even looking or searching or trying to research anything. I just remember the M-A-M-A. It would always do that very fast on the board when it presented itself. And when I learned that this was a known demonic spirit, also known as Zozo, it really bothered me. And I want to know what your thoughts are on that.
Well, my first thing would be, did it feel demonic to you? Did you feel that you were threatened? Was there...
But I sassed it, for lack of a better word. I would sass it and say, oh, you know, you can't harm me. I am in my world, and I'm safe and confident in my moral compass with God, and I know what you're trying to do, and I'll communicate with you and play games with you, but you are not allowed in my life. And I remember always telling it that. It would get very angry if you challenged it. It lied. Sometimes it would try to pretend it was someone else. They would say it was another name, but the way it was moving on the board, we knew it was that same entity. And when we would call it out and say, you know what, your name isn't blah, blah, this is M-A-M-A. And it would use very explicit vulgar words. It wouldn't use evil words. It was vulgar. It would just try to be vulgar. And I would challenge it and say, you're done. Goodbye. You only get to have power when I talk to you. So leave me alone. We would sass it and be all challenging. And years later, now that I learned that, my behavior with it, speaking to it that way and disregarding its potential that I know nothing about, because nobody knows anything about that realm technically. We can only just observe and speculate. It disturbs me. So I am freaked out that Mama, M-A-M-A, years later, is a documented, known, mythological, or whatever you want to call it, spirit, and decades ago it told me it always followed me around, and that floored me.
Go ahead,
well,
Michelle.
It sounds more mischievous. I mean, one of the real dangers with a Ouija board is, you know, it's a tool like a gun or a hammer, where if you don't know what you're doing with it, and most people don't, you can get hurt or you can hurt somebody else, because it can be an effective tool. You know, you can use a hammer to build a house, but you can also bash somebody's skull in. So the Zozo phenomenon. Also, like the way you're saying, like you can tell who you're talking to based on the way things are moving. I've witnessed that. I completely know what you're talking about. I disagree on some of the Zozo phenomenon, because I've watched that happen, and the swinging back and forth, that sort of like wild thing from one side to the other. The Ama and Zozo have everything to do with just the way the letters are arranged. And it's the motion that is more particular to that, to what's going on there. It's almost too much energy. What I have seen when I have witnessed people working with stuff like that, and specifically that swinging back and forth across the board, is more common with something that is mischievous and has more energy than the negative power, a trickster, if you will. Not necessarily something I would fully class as a demon, but something that would be perfectly happy to put on a demon face if that's what got it attention. So in your case, I would say don't be so scared that this is something that's always with you. Do you have something that's following you around as a result of this?
And what percent, Michelle, of these demons are dangerous to people? Is it a high number?
Well, a better question is, what percent are actually demons? And that's really the rub, is there are far fewer instances where something is what I would legitimately call a demon. I have a narrow range based off of all my reading and experience of what I would classify as a demon. It has to be non-human, something that has never been able to be human, something that is hyper-intelligent, something that is malevolent and very specifically fixated on being malevolent toward people. But there are lots of other spirits and things out there, and many of which are non-human, not all of which are as powerful or as bent on harm and destruction, and specifically as bent on trying to get into people. I think that non-human quality is a fairly important thing. This is drawn from, I'd mentioned the Book of Enoch. There's a passage there where they talk about after the flood, having destroyed all of these forbidden beings that were, you know, angel and human, Nephilim, Gibberim, whatever you want to call them. And they're all killed, but they are not able to leave. They no longer have physical form, but they're here. And they are angry, and they are jealous, and they are condemned to walk and to never be part of our world again, but to always desire it and want to be back in it. And it really sets the stage in just that passage for Western demonology, for the existence of these beings that are close to humanity, but bigger than humans.
Have you ever known of a paranormal investigator, Michelle, that was hurt by a demon?
I have seen people who have displayed scratches. I've seen people who have displayed bruises, and certainly instances where they felt that that was demonic activity. Unfortunately, I've also seen scratches, bruises, and the like manifest on people in poltergeist and instances that I would say did not involve a demon. Did involve a spirit, but not necessarily a demon. So sometimes, but much more rarely than I think people claim or that people are afraid of. It's important to understand it is extreme cases and rare cases where it is true demonic possession, true demonic activity. You know, are there dangers out there? Are there ways that people can get hurt? Absolutely. Some of the biggest risks are more about treading on very dodgy psychological territory where we manage to do more harm to ourselves with our fear than with what's actually going on.
How much of it could be just plain mental illness? Because that happens too.
Yeah, no, and one of the things that's really important to note is in the three cases that I was directly involved with in Paranormal State particularly, that I would say there was demonic activity. There was also mental illness. And it was really hard to chicken and the egg. Were these individuals manifesting depression, anxiety, and other issues as a result of having been under spiritual warfare for so long? Or were they weakened because of pre-existing conditions and then became preyed upon? And it was very difficult to pull those threads apart. And it's also why we always worked both with a priest and with somebody who had a background in psychology.
Well, you stay safe, Michelle, and stay out of harm's way, my friend. Michelle Boulanger, her website linked up at coasttocoastam.com. It is her name. Up next, a special hour of Sound Off Open Lines.